4 years after Katrina, the people of New Orleans are of two minds about their city. Some say it's still struggling to recover from the floodwaters.
My memory is muddy. What's this river that I'm near? New Orleans is sinking, man, and I don't want to swim.
I think about the future is going to be bad, but it's going to be us to stop this, because if we try more better and try more harder and think better than everybody else, and we write a story about what's going on, I think we can change it. Only society can do that.
Others say New Orleans is on the rise.
I can see clearly now that the rain is gone.
We'll get a clear look at the forecast in New Orleans on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 15th. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow. Coming up this hour, you heard that clip from a guy in New Orleans on AM New York saying that things are bad there. Are they bad or are they getting better or both? Also, Wall Street's rally, the Dow topped 10,000, but does that really matter? And not so fast, Rush. Is Limbaugh getting cut from the NFL? That's in and out, as well as that Thursday Tech Talk is coming up. But first, Bill Barrow is with us. He's a staff reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. So, Bill, we hear all kinds of conflicting reports out of New Orleans. But what's right? Is the city in dire straits still, or is it improving every day?
I think it depends on where you live in the city. Charles Dickens could probably write a follow-up to A Tale of Two Cities in New Orleans.
It's both.
So it's both. We've come a long way, but there's a long way to go.
Bill Barrow, stay with us. But first, everything else that you need to know this morning. In the headlines, in Pakistan, police say a bomb has exploded near a school in the northwestern city of Peshawar. That's as at least 39 are dead in a series of attacks across the country today. Teams of gunmen hit three law enforcement facilities in Lahore. Looking at the economy, Asian stocks followed the trend on Wall Street. They've rallied to a year high on the heels of the Dow topping 10,000. And we're expecting big news from Wall Street this morning. Goldman Sachs is expected to post big profits, and Citibank is posting their earnings today as well. As we've been saying, the president heads to New Orleans today. It's his first trip to the Crescent City since moving into the White House. Yesterday, he urged Congress to authorize another stimulus check for Social Security recipients, veterans, and people with disabilities. The government's expected to announce today that there will not be a cost of living increase for Social Security payments. Foreclosure rates were up more than 5% last quarter. Realty Track says that's because of a flood of defaults among people who lost their jobs. And in about 30 minutes, we're going to get a closer look at the job market with the latest unemployment claims. Markets were up more than 1% yesterday. The Dow's going to kick off next hour at 10,016. The S&P starts trade at 1092, and the NASDAQ will start at 2172. So we're asking today, if President Obama was coming to your city today instead of New Orleans, what would you tell him about your city? And we get a Facebook posting from Phil. He says he can fix the rickety floor tile missing, ceiling fan falling in building where I teach with the elephant piss smelling bathrooms. So much for clean and safe environments. That's Phil's take. What's yours? 8778-MY-TAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee. So the president is heading to New Orleans today, and The Takeaway is going to follow him south. He's going to be holding a town hall meeting at the University of New Orleans. He's also stopped by the Dr. Martin Luther King Charter School in the Lower Ninth Ward. So this morning, we're going to talk with some New Orleans locals about what they want President Obama to see and hear about and address while he's down there in the Crescent City. We're joined by Bill Barrow, a staff reporter for the Times-Picayune. We're also going to hear from Diana Pinkley, Secretary of the Executive Committee for the Women of the Storm. Clarence White is a social worker and outreach worker for a nonprofit that's serving in New Orleans. And Eric Jensen is the director of youth engagement for an after-school partnership. So, Bill, let's start with you. Can you give us a rundown on what, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of issues that need to be addressed in New Orleans, but what are, say, the top four?
Well, the top four, in no particular order, directly related to recovery, I would say health care. The downtown New Orleans is still without a major teaching hospital. Charity hospital's been closed since then, and the state is in the middle of a dispute with the federal government trying to settle how much they're owed for Katrina damage, and that's a key piece of building a replacement hospital. There's still a dearth of affordable housing in the city, with and that's going to involve a lot of federal money and HUD money coming in. There are other public assistance program disputes with FEMA and local governments to rebuild fire stations, schools, things like that. And then, not directly related to recovery, but prevention, and this is perhaps really the most important long-term, is rebuilding the coastal wetlands that hold out storm surge when hurricanes come in.
Okay, so you talked about rebuilding the coastal wetlands. Luckily, we have Diana Pinkley here. She's with the Women of the Storm. Diana, what needs to be done in order to pay attention to Katrina damage and maybe prevent this kind of thing from happening again down there?
Well, basically, Bill's right. I mean, we have a lot of issues with housing and infrastructure, but if we don't fix our, what we call our speed bumps for hurricanes, our wetlands, all of it will be for naught because this will happen again. We're losing those wetlands at a rate of one football field every 38 to 50 minutes. So think about it. During your show, you're going to lose, what, four football fields, five football fields? Open golf. What needs to be done is, scientists know, we know what needs to be done. We need to let the Mississippi River nourish those wetlands like it did before 1927 when it was walled in. We need to open some diversions. Congress has passed, actually has authorized, four projects that haven't sadly been funded yet. So we need to get near-term funding to start out on that.
Now, Diana,
energy and the economic resources of the port down here.
But Diana, 4 years ago, the entire nation watched in horror when New Orleans was completely submerged in water and the damage that came afterwards. And everyone said, look at what a lesson this is, that we didn't pay attention to the levees. We didn't pay attention to this before this happened. 4 years later, we still have not fixed the problem. In other words, if a hurricane hit New Orleans again right now, would we see devastation yet again?
It's very hard to say. Sometimes we have to repeat our lessons to learn them. And like Bill says, some things are better, some things are not. The levees that protect the city specifically are somewhat better. They're not as good as they need to be. And it's a national issue. Half of the people in America live behind, are protected by levees. And in many cases, these levees are not up to the engineering standards that they should be. And we've learned to pay attention. We've learned to pay very close attention, which we probably didn't before August 29th, 2005.
Okay. Clarence White, you are a social worker and outreach worker there. You heard that Bill Barrow was also talking about the homeless situation and the housing situation, affordable housing. You work with the group Unity Welcome Home, and you have firsthand experience with this, right? Because you're still, you became homeless after the storm, and you are still not in a house. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm 90% completed, and I was on your show in August this year. And I'm waiting for a building inspector to come out and inspect my home where I can get energy services. I commute back and forth to Baton Rouge to stay with my daughter, but at times over the weekend, I'm at my home in the dark. I do have water, but I'm ready to get in. But I like to say one thing about all the abandoned buildings in New Orleans. As an outreach worker for the nonprofit agency that I work with, we have made a list of 65,000 abandoned buildings in New Orleans. 6,000 of those buildings are occupied by homeless individuals.
Mm. So. Now, Bobby Jindal turned down quite publicly the stimulus package from the federal government. Is part of the housing problem due to a lack of funds?
I think it is. Because one thing is that we work with these homeless individuals trying to house them through a rental assistance program that we have from the federal government. And we need our homeless individuals to have employment to get into this rental assistance. So infrastructure, street repair, and employment, that's what we need here in New Orleans.
Bill, is there an issue with funds here? It was a mistake maybe for Jindal to turn down the stimulus fund? Or are there other organizational things going on preventing them from fixing the homeless problem and the levees?
Yeah, it's more than one factor there. there are bureaucratic hurdles at various levels of government since the storm. Some of those processes have been fixed. Some of it is a financing situation. You know, one of the factors with the housing situation is that there is HUD money, Community Development Block Grant money, allocated, but all of these projects for affordable housing are designed to involve a combination of private and public financing, and you have developers that have pulled out because they can't get the financing with the credit markets such as they are. So that's the problem there that's not directly attributable to government, I don't think. So it's not to say that it's all the federal government's fault here or that there's not any HUD money. There's a kind of a confluence of factors.
Okay, we're also joined by Eric Jensen from the After School Partnership, the director of youth engagement there. And Eric, we talked yesterday on this show about the new performance review from the state of Louisiana saying that schools in Louisiana are improving and the schools in New Orleans are better than ever. Is that mean the picture for the children of New Orleans has improved since the storm?
I think it has improved. I think that, you know, New Orleans has made great strides, and the state in general has made great strides to improving education in the city. And I think the president and the secretary of education has done a great job of advocating for innovative ideas in education to happen. But one area I think we would like to specifically see more advocacy happen is in the after-school hours, because in the after-school hours or in the out-of-school hours is where you're finding young people, you know, not being productive, not learning. It's the peak hours where, you know, criminal justice and community safety come into play with young people. And so I think what we want to see, and specifically from the federal government, is to see those federal funds for Race to the Top money, for the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, for 20th Century funding. We want to see those things trickle down into the ground, into programs. Because right now, about only 15% of New Orleans public education students are in after-school programs right now, which means there's a huge amount of young people in the city that are going home to homes that are unsupervised by adults.
If they have homes.
Excuse me?
If they have homes.
If they have homes. And right now, even if we did fill up all of the slots right now in the city, you know, full of all of the after-school programs, full, only 25% of those public school students would be in programs. And so we want to see capacity building happening on the ground with after-school programming and summer learning programs as well.
So, Bill Barrow, that's Eric Jensen's with the After School Partnership, but Bill Barrow of the Times-Picayune, the president is going to stop by the Dr. Martin Luther King Charter School in Lower Ninth Ward. Is this a signal to you that he's going to be especially addressing issues of the educational system there?
They've not really given us a clue exactly what he's going to talk about. I certainly presume since he put that stop on two things. Obviously, I think he wants to stop in the Ninth Ward. That certainly plays very well to the national audience. But it is an opportunity if he chooses to talk about charter schools. That gives him the perfect venue to do so. So I certainly would expect him to endorse the kind of things that the educational community in New Orleans has been doing since the storm.
Last question for you, Bill, quickly. The New Orleans population came out in force to support President Obama in the last election. Is his visit there welcome?
It is certainly welcome, but there is a subtext here that people think it's not quite long enough, and they initially, he's going to be on the ground less than 4 hours. It's sort of strange he's coming to New Orleans and not sitting down for a meal, and what a city not to come have a meal in. He is going to get a to-go order from one of the local famous spots where he has dined before, but there are people that are a little perplexed that he's not staying a little longer and seeing more of the city.
Okay, Bill Barrow is a staff reporter for the Times-Picayune. We also talked to Eric Jensen, director of youth engagement for After School Partnership, Clarence White, social worker and outreach worker for Unity Welcome Home, and Diana Pinkley with the Women of the Storm. You may have heard me say New Orleans instead of New Orleans. If you look that up, it's not a mispronunciation. It turns out there's dozens of pronunciations of New Orleans, and they're all correct.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories that we're following this week. We're going to go to Washington first. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is out this week, so filling in is our friend Julie Mason. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Okay, good morning, Julie. I'm trying to
good
see
morning.
If I can get this relationship between the insurance industry and the Democrats straight, because it started out very rosy, Obama and the insurance industry coming together, working together, and then as of Sunday, the insurance industry comes onto these ads and pretty much says the Obama administration, bring it, right? And so now the Democrats are bringing it. What? How are the Democrats responding?
Well, you know, this has been percolating ever since the Democrats quit calling this health care reform and started calling it health insurance reform. So this is brewing for a while. But what they're threatening to do is repeal an exemption that grants all regulatory control of the health insurance industry to the states. And repealing it would put the industry back under the thumb of the federal government.
This is an antitrust exemption that they got.
Exactly. Exactly right. And the industry is calling it a political ploy, and it sort of is. Really.
But can we say that this is payback for those television ads that we've been seeing scaring seniors about
Medicare? Right, and that also something we've been talking about this week, which was that trade group report that warned that healthcare reform was going to raise premiums $4,000 per family. It got everyone all fired up before the Senate Finance Committee vote earlier this week. So it's a little bit of payback. It's not clear if the Democrats in Congress are going to go ahead with it. There's one bill out there that would repeal the exemption, but unclear where it's heading.
Or whether it would have a chance to pass. Okay,
indeed.
Thanks, Julie Mason,
sure.
White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. And now it's time to talk about some sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaways sports contributor. Okay, so Ibrahim, you wrote this blog on our website about the possibility of Rush Limbaugh being part of the group that purchased the St. Louis Rams.
Correct.
And it struck a nerve.
Somehow it did. I wonder why.
You wonder why? This is a controversial thing. So we have new developments in this story. There were many football players who spoke out and said they didn't want to play for Rush Limbaugh. There were accusations of racism from Limbaugh. And what's the newest development?
So basically, the group that is that was making the push, which included owners of other franchises as well, has decided that Rush Limbaugh is out of that group now because he caused too much controversy, essentially, that he made it difficult for them. And so now he's out. But this doesn't mean that he's not going to necessarily make a bid on his own. I think people need to realize that Rush Limbaugh might use this as something to rally around and get together his own group of people to gather up the money and make a push for that ownership as well. If he's really serious about ownership, you know, he started out his career as a PR person for the Kansas City Royals, and he's known for treating his employees quite well. So perhaps he might have a group of loyal folks around him that are actually going to rally up around him.
Well, how much influence did these players who spoke out actually have, these players who said, I would not play for him?
The question is, I think it's not so much the players that had that focus, the influence. I think it's the sort of cacophony of voices that had an influence. The players' association, the owners that said that they wouldn't support him. Mark Cuban, actually, who's the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, the basketball team, that came out and said he wouldn't. And then Roger Goodell, who's the commissioner, stepped up and said that he didn't know the controversy that his comments make made him hesitate about his potential ownership. So it was all of those factors combined. I think if just the players had said something, maybe it wouldn't have reached this point. But I think all of that group of people made it seem like a very a risky business proposition, and it affected the business model at the end of the day.
Well, whatever anybody may think of Rush Limbaugh, there are many owners of major teams who are not necessarily Mother Teresa. I mean, they may not be quite so public about it. Maybe they're not much in the public eye, but, you know, we've got Jay-Z. He's the owner of the we've got Mark Cuban. He's very controversial in what he says. We've got Jay-Z is the owner of the New Jersey Nets. So, I mean.
So on that tip, I was thinking about that a lot. And I think that compares apples and oranges. Rush Limbaugh is literally one of the most well-known people in America. And for him, most of the owners that you see, they might have political views that are this way or that way, but they stay behind the scenes. And I think it's a different kind of relationship with the
team.
But
you could see Rush's argument that, you know, some of these people have more controversial views than I do, but, you know, it's okay for them to have them as long as they shut up about it, right?
They're not in a league, or they're not playing. They're not making statements specifically around race and around black people, which he has made in a league that has 65% to 70% of the players that are black. I think that that's where therein lies the rub, as you would say. And also Rush, you know, he's been very outspoken specifically against specific players.
Like Donovan McNabb.
Precisely. So, you know, he makes himself a target in this instance. And I'm very curious to see how the reaction is going to be on the next step of this.
And has Rush at all responded to being dropped from the group of investors who were bidding for the Rams?
That I haven't seen. I haven't seen anything that has been specific about his response.
Okay, I guess this will be a developing story. Indeed. And for those who want to see the blog that Ibrahim wrote, it is on our website. You can find it there. Thanks to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway's sports contributor. As always, our last takeout comes from you, our listener. And we've been talking a lot about the passage of the health care reform bill. You've been telling us about your worries with the current system and about some issues that may not be addressed by the new law.
I'm a Christian Scientist. And I've never used Western doctors or any kind of doctors. I just use prayer and good common sense for my health. Why should I pay for health insurance of any kind when I never use doctors and I believe that the system is completely broken?
We heard something else from Leslie of River Edge, New Jersey. She called in at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
There's something else nobody talks about. They talk about catastrophic health care. They don't talk about people that have a few dollars and they have to go in a nursing home and use all their money up and can't leave anything for their family. It's crazy.
So George emailed us with this suggestion. He says, I'm currently an independent systems contractor. I do not have health insurance, chiefly because I can't afford it. People have to take more responsibility for their own health or pay a larger share of the costs. The food industry must also be brought to the bench for its culpability. I'm responsible for my own health and I do my best to eat right and exercise and take care of myself. Unfortunately, George, I don't think there's any way for them to legislate against Big Macs, but maybe they could suggest that people eat a little better. We've also been talking this week about women serving in the armed services, and one of the people we spoke to is Army Reserve Major Paula Broadwell. She told us how it helps to have women in war zones, for instance, in Afghanistan.
They're welcomed in the society, and even the Afghan men view them as less threatening than an American male soldier.
So Gina wrote in on the website at thetakeaway.org, I served with Major Broadwell in Germany for several years, and she's absolutely right about the contribution that men and women make in today's military. It's a matter of using the skills people have to their best ability. Gina posted that comment at thetakeaway.org. You can talk to us about anything that you've heard. Make a comment or ask a question. Anything that you'd like to hear. 877-8-MY-TAKE or give us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And today we're asking you, President Obama is visiting New Orleans to hear from those residents. If he was coming to your town, what would you tell him about your town? What do you need in your town and what should the president know? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. The Dow topped 10,000 yesterday, but should we all be cheering like the Wall Street traders as the banks also boast profits? Or should we all be saying, so what? There's thousands of people still unemployed. We're going to be talking about that in just a few minutes. But first, at 32 minutes past the hour, we get all the news headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Celeste. We've got a key economic indicator just out a couple minutes ago. Weekly jobless claims are down. The latest numbers show 514,000 Americans filed for new unemployment payments. That's actually a little bit better than analysts were expecting. We'll watch those numbers throughout the morning. President Obama will be in New Orleans this afternoon, as we've been talking about. It's his first visit there since taking office as president. He'll view building sites, visit a charter school in the lower Ninth Ward, and hold a town hall meeting. Overseas, a bomb has exploded in Pakistan's northwest, the latest in a series of attacks there. Government buildings were among the targets. At least 39 are dead. The Boston Globe is no longer for sale. The New York Times Company, which owns the Globe, now says the paper's financial situation has improved. And, of course, a reminder that the New York Times is one of the production partners of The Takeaway, this program. In California today, more than 6 million people will take part in the largest earthquake drill ever. Many schools and businesses will practice how to deal with an earthquake. And baseball's next playoff round kicks off tonight with the National League Championship Series. That's the Phillies playing the L.A. Dodgers. Those are some of the stories we're following.
So this was the scene on Wall Street yesterday. Jubilation. Cheers erupting as the Dow Jones Industrial Average crossed that 10,000 mark. A welcome sign of economic recovery. Maybe. It's happened 25 times before, actually, so it's certainly not unprecedented, and we're still 4,000 points below the 2008 all-time high. So we're going to find out exactly whether or not that was a true cause for celebration with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and Ed Andrews, Washington economics correspondent for The New York Times. Louise, the Dow Jones closed above 10,000. Does that mean that people are actually making real money?
Well, if you think about it, it's a little depressing that we were at 10,000 in March 1999. That's the first time it burst through this level. And there's actually a lot of similarities here because back then they passed out these Dow 10,000 baseball caps and people put them on and they popped open champagne. And yesterday they passed out Dow 10,000 baseball caps again.
They said
Dow
10,000
2.0. But, you know, here we are 10 years later. And if you think of what the stock market is supposed to be for average investors out there, it's supposed to be this place where if you put your savings, your retirement portfolio, and you just have some patience over a few decades, you'll make a good return. And I would say zero in 10 years is not a good return.
I would imagine most people would agree with you. So, I mean, is the Dow a good indicator of the economy? Is this a strong sign of the economic recovery in the U.S.?
So, you know, it is an indicator. It certainly indicates what investors think about the future earnings of the companies that are in this index. They're mostly large companies, but it's not a direct indicator because, first of all, stock prices are often wrong. I mean, they're often based on people feeling a certain euphoria or people feeling a certain pessimism. You know, so it has this relation. It also has the relationship of if we all see the stock market going up and we all see our portfolios doing better, then maybe we'll go to the shopping malls and spend more money and maybe it will help the economy just to have a better mood out there. So it has kind of a tangential, psychological, fuzzy relationship, but it's definitely not tied to the direct economy.
So Ed Andrews, Washington economics correspondent for The New York Times. This is all coming amidst these new earnings reports from our major banks. We're expecting profits to be announced by Goldman Sachs today, which many people say is a sign of the economic recovery. But at the same time, these big banks are owned, many of them, in part by the U.S. government and by the American taxpayers. Are they expected to pay back the bailout money they collected?
Well, it turns out that the Treasury Department now would like to see more of these companies pay back the money that they infused into them 1 year ago. The funny part about this is that when the Treasury Department started doing this a year ago, they were basically force-feeding it, ramming the money down the throats of a couple of these companies that claim that they didn't need it. And so now, though, things are looking better, at least with some of the big institutions, and their profits are up. Their pay packages are up to record levels in some cases, and Treasury is saying, you know, hey, it would be nice to see that money paid back.
Is that really how they're saying it? It would be nice? It's like a little nice suggestion?
They're kind of in a funny position. They don't want to encourage banks to get into a weakened position. They actually, you know, over the long haul, they want banks to have higher capital positions than they have in the past, at least in the past decade. They want them to have strong capital buffers against future risks and losses, but the banks have been able to raise a lot of capital in the last year. They've been making a lot of money in the last quarter or so, and more importantly, you know, the Treasury feels like or officials are beginning to feel that the banks can replace the government stake with money raised through capital sources quite easily. The trouble is that the banks are now going, well, you know, yeah, but if we do that, we're going to dilute shareholders. So people that were kind of hostile about taking government money a year ago
now don't want to give the money back.
Yeah.
So, Louise, you know, we've been hearing a lot about banks reporting profits. We've also heard that many of the salaries and bonuses are right back to the level they were before the economic meltdown.
That's right.
So the banks have they have the money, right, to pay back the government loans?
You know, they're all in different positions, but there are some that have it. And it's interesting, when Ed was talking, it was reminding me, Ed, I'm sure you remember, a kind of famous story from a year ago when the Treasury Department called the 9 banking chiefs from the largest banks into that secretive meeting where they first gave them the bailout money. It's been reported that Jamie Dimon, the chief executive of J.P. Morgan, kind of looked around at his peers when they were passing out the money and said, this is kind of cheap money. The government's not really charging us much for that. And that's what we're seeing now with these banks who don't want to give it back. J.P. Morgan did give it back, but there's some who are resistant because it is cheap capital.
Yeah,
it's a good deal for the banks. And even though Treasury could probably use that money now to help real Americans, maybe use that money to help unemployed people or something instead, the banks kind of like this cheap capital.
Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times, and Edmund Andrews, Washington economics correspondent for the New York Times. Goldman Sachs has reported earnings. It earned more than $3 billion in the third quarter. Citigroup, on the other hand, reported a third quarter loss of $3.24 billion today. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. You probably recognize that music. That's the Liberty Bell by John Philip Sousa. But if it's familiar to you, it's probably because that's also the opening music for Monty Python's Flying Circus. The show was short-lived. It aired in the UK from 1969 to 1974, but the influence of the group on comedy is often compared to the Beatles' influence on music. Tonight, the 5 surviving Pythons will gather at New York City's Ziegfeld Theater to mark the 40th anniversary of the TV show's debut, and they'll receive a special award from the British Academy of Film and Television Arts. So maybe you're not a fan. If so, you're probably wondering, what's all the fuss about? Who else could write a 6-minute sketch about processed meat products? Who else would? Even if you don't like the jokes, most Americans have heard the Lumberjack song or seen something from the Ministry of Silly Walks. Monty Python's Flying Circus was a wickedly smart, completely absurd stream of consciousness, such as the world had never seen before.
That parrot is definitely deceased. And when I bought it not half an hour ago, you assured me that its lack of movement was due to it being tired and shagged out after a long squawk.
The Norwegian Blue prefers kipping on its back. It's a beautiful bird, lovely plumage.
Look, I took the liberty of examining that parrot, and I discovered that the only reason that it had been sitting on its perch in the first place was that it had been nailed there.
These 6 guys threw out all the rules of traditional comedy. In fact, Python-esque even found its way into the dictionary to describe a surreal or absurd brand of humor. Only in Python could a man spend 7 minutes trying to buy cheese, pay 50 quid for an argument, or be constantly interrupted by the cronies of Torquemada.
Mr. Wentworth just told me to come in here and say that there was trouble at the mill, that's all. I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. Our chief weapon is surprise. Surprise and fear. Fear and surprise are 2 weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency are 3 weapons. Our fear and surprise and ruthless efficiency and an almost fanatical devotion to the Pope are 4. No. Amongst our weaponry are such elements as fear. I'll come in again.
Just 45 TV episodes and a few movies, but their campy, preposterous humor is now part of American culture. 3 of the 6 Python members are included in the list of the 50 greatest comedians of all time. This is actor-writer Simon Pegg of Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz fame.
And I just remember watching it as a 15-year-old kid and just loving the fact that they found it funny and they were enjoying it, and seeing them having such enormous fun just dressing up as old women and being utterly batty.
And our own Femi Okeh found that overseas, expatriates can even find common ground in one another's Monty Python memories.
There's not a lot of Americans in Dubai, but there's tons of Brits. Their Brits are everywhere, and Monty Python is like currency. If you can chalk Monty Python, you can talk to any British person. It's fantastic stuff. So if I'm stuck in a meeting with people and don't really know how to break the ice, you can always start talking Monty Python.
And as crazy as Monty Python humor was, they also weren't afraid to push the boundaries and dance on the edge of controversy. In a classic parody of the movie Spartacus, their film The Life of Brian ends with the main character hanging from a cross while nearby victims break into song. 40 years old today, a tip of the derby to Monty Python for teaching us that nothing is sacred, everything can be funny, and we're often at our best when we're laughing at ourselves.
If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Hey.
Always look on the bright side of life.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up in just a few moments, if you see a Volkswagen Bug from the Geek Squad driving down the road, who do you imagine is behind the wheel? Well, if you guess a very white male, you're probably correct. Unfortunately, not much diversity in the tech industry, and we're going to be talking about that in just a few minutes. But first, a check-in on all the news headlines with Mark Garrison at 47 minutes past the hour.
Thank you, Celeste. Just this hour, we've got two economic indicators just out. Weekly jobless claims are down. The latest numbers show 514,000 Americans filed for new unemployment payments. That's a little better than forecasters predicted. And the largest measure of inflation is up 0.2%. That's lower than last month's increase, and also it's a little lower than analysts were expecting overall. Energy costs have gone up, but food prices have gone down. The staying with business, good news and bad news for the titans of finance. Earnings reports are just out this morning. Goldman Sachs posted $3 billion in quarterly profits today, but Citigroup says it lost more than $3 billion. Back in the U.S., the president heads to New Orleans today to survey the rebuilding there. He'll also visit the only school to reopen in the lower Ninth Ward. And baseball's next playoff round kicks off tonight with the National League Championship Series. And in Pakistan, dozens are dead after a wave of violence targeting government sites.
And we're going to talk more about that story today with Adam Minot, the BBC correspondent, reporting on this from Bush House in London. I spoke with him earlier today, and I started out by asking him exactly what happened today.
Well, a very severe attack targeted at three locations in the city of Lahore, which is in the east of Pakistan. Now, Lahore is known as the cultural capital of Pakistan, and until recent times had been viewed really as a peaceful city. But these three attacks, two on police training centers and one on a federal investigation unit of the police, that's where police carry out anti-insurgency operations.
So is this a continuation of the string of militant attacks that we've seen over the past week or so, or is this maybe in response to the airstrikes that carried out by the Pakistani military?
We don't know yet, because no one has said they carried out these attacks, but it does look now as though there is some coordinated insurgency action going on, because as you said, there have been a number of attacks during the course of the past week or 10 days or so, including a very daring attack on the military headquarters in Rawalpindi near the capital Islamabad at the weekend, and a few days before that an attack on a United Nations building. And it does now appear as though insurgency groups, among them the Taliban, but other insurgency groups as well, are now apparently able to carry out these coordinated assaults almost with impunity. Their people get killed in these attacks, but they seem to choose their targets at will and attack at will.
Well, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that although these attacks are going on, she doesn't have any doubts of the stability of the Pakistan government. Do you have complete faith in the stability of the Pakistani government?
Well, I think there are now serious question marks over the stability of the government, because if these insurgent groups are able to attack where they choose and apparently when, and when they pick out targets like these police headquarters today and the military headquarters at the weekend, that they can carry out these attacks and the attacks are not prevented before they get anywhere near these installations, then I think there are serious question marks. I mean, the background to these attacks certainly is a campaign being waged against the Taliban in the tribal areas bordering Afghanistan, and that border is very porous, so there undoubtedly insurgent groups have come across from Afghanistan as well. But I think they do threaten the very integrity of the nation, certainly.
Okay. Adam Minot is correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Thank you so much. It's Thursday, and that means it's time to talk about technology here on The Takeaway. And I was joking about it a bit earlier, but it's actually a serious subject. The fact of the matter is that computer technology, engineering, they're mostly dominated by white males and increasingly people from South Asia. And for people in this industry, this is a cause of concern. To talk about this today, we have Marissa Mayer. She's the Vice President of Search Product and User Experience at Google. Also, Philip Harlow, Xerox's Chief Diversity Officer, and Donna Nelson, who's an Associate Professor of Chemistry at the University of Oklahoma, author of A National Analysis in Science and Engineering Faculties at Research Universities. So, Marissa, it's accurate, actually, to think of engineers mostly as white guys or maybe people from guys, from South Asia?
Well, certainly what we're seeing is that the majority of engineers are men, and that's true across all the different fields. The number of women are climbing in most engineering fields. Chemical engineering, and some of the environmental engineering in particular has been growing. In computer science, actually, it's the only engineering discipline that's seen a decline in women since 2000.
And minorities as well.
That's right.
So, Donna Nelson, you studied this, the National Analysis in Science and Engineering Facilities at Research Universities. Are the numbers declining in colleges as well?
Well, in some cases among the students they are, but happily we are seeing increases among the faculty. The increases are alarmingly slow, but they are the numbers among the faculty are increasing, which is very good because the faculty will be role models and mentors for the students, and so hopefully it will encourage the female students to persist.
Why is this issue? Why do we have so few minorities? African Americans, for example, Native Americans, Hispanics, and women. Why are there so few of them?
Well, exactly why. There's probably multiple reasons. For one thing, there's a historical problem, and so we've just only recently have started really focusing a lot of attention on this, and so we've started looking at this, and the numbers were very low when we started out, and we've been making very slow progress. A lot of people say too slow of progress, and so the increments are just too small, and so we haven't overcome the problem yet. To quantify the problem a little, if you would like, for example, in engineering, on average, we're increasing the representation of women at about 2.5% over a period of 5 years. That's 0.5% per year, and so it's going to take us forever at this rate to reach equality. And in engineering, in computer science, over a period of 5 years, we've increased only 2%. So that's 0.4% per year. So you can see it's going to take us a long time at this rate. We're clearly going to have to speed up.
Okay, so we're going to talk to Marissa about being the first woman engineer at Google in just a moment. But first, Philip Harlow, you're Xerox's chief diversity officer. Why does Xerox need a diversity officer?
Well, I think it's really nothing more than ensuring that we maintain the kind of focus that we have had the benefit of having a pretty good reputation as it relates to our historical efforts around equal employment opportunity, and it's really just a matter of providing oversight for a variety of strategies and initiatives.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but your reputation is one thing. That's totally understandable. You want to be seen as a company that's diverse.
Right.
But is there any business advantage to having a diverse workforce?
Well, we believe so. We believe, and we treat our diversity initiatives as a business imperative. And I think it's driven from the premise that, as a technology company, we recognize that our long-term success is based on the premise of being as creative and innovative as we can as a company. And we embraced a philosophy some years ago that we believe the more diverse we are as an organization, the more creative we're going to be, the more creative ideas, new ideas that will come to the table, diversity of thought will be, facilitated. So obviously the simple concept that says that, we really don't want to have people in an environment that come from the same place with the same type of thinking. So we have a variety of strategies to try to facilitate ongoing integration of a diversity of ideas and interest within our work environment.
Okay, so Marissa, as I mentioned, you were the first woman engineer at Google. And you said on the Charlie Rose program that the founders of Google try to keep at least 25% of women. That seems like such an arbitrary number. First, tell me how did you come to be the first woman engineer at Google?
Well, I was studying computer science at Stanford, and one of my professors gave my name to Larry and Sergey when they were doing recruiting. And Larry and Sergey actually were really thoughtful as they set up Google. They had spent some time trying to figure out what kind of company they'd like to build, and they had read various studies that said, you know, you really want a gender balance in the workplace.
It's, if
you
it's have such an engineer thing. They read a report that says they need 25% women, and they say, okay, we need 25% women.
Well, balanced in either direction. They basically said if you have a workforce that becomes less than 25% of either gender, communication and collaboration doesn't work as well. And so since obviously engineering and computer science is male-dominated, they said, okay, we really want to have the goal of 25% women in our technical area.
Marissa Mayer is the vice president of Search Product and User Experience in Google. Philip Harlow, Xerox's Chief Diversity and Employee Advocacy Officer, and Donna Nelson is an Associate Professor of Chemistry at the University of Oklahoma. So that's the tech industry. What does it look like at your workplace?
Hi, my name's Andrew, and I'm a medical student in East Brunswick, New Jersey. 3 years ago, I worked at Best Buy as a Geek Squad computer technician, and my co-partners in crime were two Cuban guys who had side jobs as bounty hunter and as a bouncer.
That's diversity in the office place. Is there diversity in your office? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. We're also taking your thoughts about what you would tell President Obama if he was coming to visit your city today instead of New Orleans. I don't know about you, but I can't make up my mind about healthcare reform until I know more. Give me more. I want more. I've listened to all the debates, but I still feel like I'm getting two different versions of the truth.
Congress is proposing over $100 billion in cuts to Medicare Advantage. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says many seniors will see cuts in benefits.
There are a lot of things in our bill that would cause premiums to go down.
As we get close to really getting reform done, they've gotten more worried about their profits.
Can we get some fact-checking up in here? I said the truth is here, the truth is here. You've been searching for the truth, and you'll find it here on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 15th. I'm Celeste Headlee, going it alone for one more day. John Hockenberry will be back tomorrow. Coming up this hour, is it already too late for the United States to win in Afghanistan? We'll answer that question. We're going to ask why we didn't know that Wall Street bankers were getting Treasury jobs. Also, nickel and dimed author Barbara Ehrenreich's new book is Down on Positivity. But first, we're going to go to John Gerby. He's a healthcare economist at MIT, and he helped Massachusetts develop its universal health insurance plan. So, John, how much of these costs are up to interpretation in healthcare, and how much of it can we figure out is true or untrue?
You know, there's no way to really know. We have to really try to estimate. But fortunately, at the federal level, we have an official estimator, which is the Congressional Budget Office. So I think we look to what they say where possible, and where not, we have to make our best estimate.
John Gruber, stay with us. We're going to be talking to you more in just a few minutes. But first, everything else that you need to know this morning in the headlines. Lots of economic news this morning. New unemployment claims dropped unexpectedly last week, and the total number of people on the unemployment payrolls dropped below 6 million. Prices were up slightly for consumers last month. September posted inflation of 0.2% as gas prices rose. Mixed earnings news on Wall Street today. Goldman Sachs posted $3 billion in profits, but Citigroup announced a loss of more than $3 billion. Overseas in Pakistan, there are reports of another bombing in the country's northwest. That's as at least 39 are dead in a series of attacks across the country today. And as we've been saying, the president heads to New Orleans today. It's his first trip to the Crescent City since moving into the White House. Yesterday, the president urged Congress to authorize another stimulus check for Social Security recipients, veterans, and people with disabilities. The government announced today that there won't be a cost of living increase for Social Security payments next year. And J.C. Dugard is speaking out for the first time since being held captive for 18 years. She tells People magazine that she's, quote, so happy to be back with my family. Markets were up more than 1% yesterday. The Dow is going to kick off this hour at 10,016. The S&P starts trading at 1092, and the NASDAQ is going to open up at 2172. So President Obama, as we said, is in New Orleans today. That city definitely needs some help. But if the president were coming to your town, what would you tell him about your city?
My name is Kathy. I'm calling from Michigan. And I would like for the president, if he came to my city, to fix the unemployment rate. I voted for him, and since he had come into office, I was hoping that things would be for the better, and it has actually gone down. My husband worked in the auto industry and has since lost his job.
Tell us what you think at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. So during the Clinton administration, the insurance companies were extremely vocal during that health care reform debate. In fact, some people say that the insurance industry defeated any chance at health care overhaul then. But during the past few months, the insurance industry has been relatively quiet until now. That changed this past week. We're joined now by Brad Flugel. He's the executive president and chief strategy and external affairs officer for the health insurer WellPoint. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning, Celeste.
So the Senate Finance Committee bill that passed on Tuesday, do you support that particular bill?
I think there are a lot of good elements of that bill, but there are a few pieces of the bill that passed a couple of days ago which we think are unworkable.
What are those?
Well, the main issue that we're trying to address through the health care reform initiatives are to try to make health insurance more affordable for American families. And a few of the components of what's included in that bill will, in fact, have the opposite impact. Some of those include new taxes that are being applied on various component parts of the healthcare industry, like insurance companies, pharmaceutical manufacturers, and medical device manufacturers. There's also significant cuts that are going to be made to the Medicare program, those costs will be shifted onto those who have private insurance, increasing the costs for those who are privately insured. And then also importantly, in order for the market reforms to work effectively and get everybody included in the pool, there needs to be strong incentives for people to take up insurance.
Okay, so Brad, we're going to be talking a little bit more about the costs of the bill in just a few minutes. But first, we've been getting personal takes and stories from our listeners, 8778-MY-TAKE, all for weeks now. We have a couple questions from some of our listeners that I wanted you to respond to. Here's one.
My name is Langston. I'm in Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Through three insurers, I have been told what medicine I can take, what doctor I can see, and what hospital I can use. I don't know why these people are trying to tell us that any sort of government plan will limit our choices. Our choices are now being run by the insurance companies.
What's your response to that?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do as insurance companies is to ensure that people get the right kind of care in the right setting, and that we make that care as affordable as possible through the insurance system. And so I'm not sure the specifics of what that individual was talking about, but there are programs in place that we have that allow people to get access to all the care that they need.
Okay. We have another question from a listener. Here's this one.
My name is Suzanne. I'm calling from Massachusetts, and I have insurance. I have great insurance, actually. And even with my insurance, I can never see my doctor. When I do see my doctor or try to see my doctor, I'm often referred to the emergency room. The 800-pound gorilla in the room is the insurance company. They're taking the money. The doctors aren't getting it. They have to take too many patients. And when they send us to the emergency room, how much does that cost?
So this is a common complaint, and many people are saying the insurance companies are complaining that premiums are going up, but they're the ones that set the premium. So what's your response to this?
Well, as you probably well know, health insurance company premiums account for, profits account for less than 1 cent of the U.S.'s healthcare dollars. And the reason that premiums are going up is that healthcare costs are going up, being driven by prices from physicians and hospitals, new medical technologies, new drugs and the likes, and that those health insurance premiums, again, are increasing because of those factors, not because of profits from health insurance companies.
Okay, so Brad Flugel with WellPoint. You guys are the largest member of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. You have lots of people that you cover, but this is a common complaint, which is that we need health care insurance because the private insurance system isn't covering enough people.
My name is Chris. I'm calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. I'm a new college graduate, graduated college in May, and because I graduated college and I'm no longer a full-time student, my health insurance coverage under my mother's plan no longer applies to me as of the end of the year. All my medical copays will now be inactive, and I'll be forced to pay full price for any medical procedure I would have to have, and also pay full price for any medications I would have to get, which is completely unreasonable. It should not be a case that you only get insurance based on whether you have a job or not.
So Brad, do you agree that the system as it stands right now with so many people uninsured is not working?
Yeah, we agree that there need to be substantial changes to the health insurance marketplace, and we proposed strong market reforms to ensure that every American has affordable coverage, and we've been advocating that for over a year now. That includes the elimination of pre-existing conditions to ensure everyone gets into the pool, that this is coupled with subsidies to low- and middle-income individuals to help them purchase coverage, that we end some of the existing rating practices based on health status and the like. So we do have a comprehensive set of proposals that would allow more people to enter the pool. But I think importantly for the caller that you just referenced who's a young adult, I think one of the things that's important as we think about reform is that we have appropriate rating rules in place so that younger Americans who often tend to be often healthier and we would like to include in the insurance pool do not have to excessively subsidize older Americans. So what's very important that the rating bands, which is the differences between what young people pay versus older people pay, are sufficiently broad to allow younger Americans to be able to afford coverage.
Okay, Brad Flugel, thanks so much. He's the Executive President and Chief Strategy and External Affairs Officer for WellPoint. So as we said earlier, the insurance companies have started to take a stand in the insurance debate. We're joined now by Robert Zirkelbach. He's a press secretary for AHIP, that's America's Health Insurance Plans, a trade group for insurance companies. And also John Gruber rejoins us. He's a healthcare economist at MIT. So we have this new report out from your group, Robert, AHIP, saying that health insurance premiums are going to rise precipitously higher through this healthcare insurance reform bill that passed on Tuesday, much higher than they would have if we'd just gone forward and hadn't changed a thing. And I wanted you to take a listen to a response from Senator John Kerry. Here he is on Tuesday at the Senate Finance Committee hearing referencing your report.
The insurance industry ought to be ashamed of this report. The fact is the Pricewaterhouse analysis is significantly flawed, and the results are simply not valid. It is a disgrace.
Objection.
That at the last minute, obfuscation of a critical.
So, Robert, how do you respond to this from Kerry?
Well, first off, thank you for having me on. And in fact, yesterday there was another report from Oliver Wyman that confirmed the findings from the PricewaterhouseCoopers report. The fact is, there are several proposals in the current health care reform that are being considered right now as part of reform that will have the unintended consequence of significantly driving up health care costs for families and employers. There are a series of new health care taxes. There is now an incentive for people to wait until they're sick to purchase coverage. And the Medicare cuts, as Brad mentioned previously, doctors and hospitals respond to those by simply charging more to people with private coverage. And that's all of those reforms are going to have a significant impact on the affordability of health care coverage. So, we support health care reform, and we have offered solutions to address these issues, and we are optimistic that something can get accomplished. But reform needs to be done in a way that's going to make coverage more affordable, and it's going to put our health care system on a more sustainable path.
Okay, John Gruber from MIT. This report claims that the cost of private health insurance would go up 79% by 2019 if we changed nothing, but it would go up 111% by 2019 under the bill that passed in the Senate Finance Committee. You did your own study of the reform proposals. What did you find?
You know, I thank you for having me on as well. You know, I really didn't do my own study. What I did is I just used data from the Congressional Budget Office.
which, you know, they're making estimates like we all are, but they have the benefit their estimates are what matter to policymakers. And the Congressional Budget Office says that under the reform passed by the Senate Finance Committee, the cost of buying a policy in the exchange will actually be lower than it is today in the non-group market. So I think, you know, different people can make different estimates. I think the point that is important that was made actually better by the Oliver Wyman report yesterday is that it's true that a weaker mandate will lead to higher premiums than a stronger mandate. That is absolutely true, and I agree with AHIP in saying that we should strengthen the mandate. I think the problem is that even with the modest mandate that we have in the Senate bill, it's still enough to lower premiums, and that's where the mistake was made. The premiums still will fall. They'd fall more with the stronger mandate, but they'll still fall even with the bill that passed.
Okay, we also got a statement from PricewaterhouseCoopers saying that they did not estimate the impact of subsidies on the net insurance cost to householders, and if other provisions in the health care reform bill are successful in lowering costs over the long term, those improvements would offset some of the higher costs that they estimated. Thank you very much. That was John Gruber, a healthcare economist at MIT, and we heard from Robert Zirkelbach, press secretary for AHIP, America's health insurance plan. That's a trade group for insurance companies.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. Let's go to Capitol Hill first. And in the absence of our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, our friend Julie Mason is filling in. She's the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Julie, the president's off to New Orleans today. It's his first visit there. And this is what the White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs has to say.
Don't judge anybody on the amount of time that they've spent there. Don't judge. Judge only what this administration promised that they would do, what they've done every day, and what they're continuing to work on.
So, Julie, what's the reaction in New Orleans? Are they judging?
Yes, they're very judgy about all this. The local paper is very unhappy. They're saying that the president's visit this afternoon lacks substance. That's from the New Orleans Times-Picayune. The problem is that Obama, as a candidate, promised to make New Orleans recovery a priority of his presidency, and not just New Orleans, but the whole Gulf Coast. Of course, Mississippi is very miffed that he's not even stopping by. They're still in bad shakes, too. So, you know, a bit of a public relations problem for the president. But when you talk to people down there, they do say that there's a lot less red tape than there was during the Bush administration. The Obama administration has released about $1 billion in recovery aid. There's more on the way. So things are happening. It's just not getting the attention, I think, that they had hoped for when Obama was elected.
Without making any excuses for anyone, I can say that, you know, President Obama promised a lot of things when he was a candidate. And is there no empathy for the fact the guy has health care reform and Afghanistan on his plate?
Right, and the economy and all these other
right,
things.
That's the problem
with promises, though. You know, he also promised to tackle immigration reform. He made a lot of promises, but he raised a lot of expectations, and certainly he did that in New Orleans as well. As a candidate, he visited there 5 times, and this is his first time as president. So they definitely feel the effect of his not prioritizing the Gulf Coast.
Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Thanks. We're now going to business with Louise Story. She's the finance reporter for our partners in the New York Times. So, Louise, yesterday we found out a little bit more about the folks making our economic policy, right? We learned about the advisors to Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. What are the details we found out yesterday?
Well, you know, I'm normally based up in New York near Wall Street, and I've been in Washington for a month, but sometimes when I'm walking around down here, I feel like I'm still in New York on Wall Street, because the truth is, a lot of people from Wall Street have moved down here to work for the government and advise on what's going on. And that's true in the Treasury Department. What came out yesterday was more information about Geithner's inner circle. And we learned about the pay and the background of Lou Alexander, who was advising him on housing policy. Lou used to be the chief economist at Citigroup. And then he has someone, Mark Patterson, there. His chief of staff was a lobbyist for Goldman Sachs. And Lee Sachs, one of his top advisors, worked for a hedge fund. Gene Sperling, another top advisor, worked part-time for Goldman, but was making in the six figures for that and over $2 million overall.
Wasn't,
so you've, you,
Wasn't this the argument against George Bush's administration that we were allowing the wolves to watch the sheep?
That was certainly an argument. And, you know, Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, brought in a bunch of advisors from Goldman at the last minute when the financial crisis started. And his argument was you needed people from Wall Street to help us figure out this mess. So, you know, Geithner could make the same argument that we're still in a financial mess and you need people who know how the markets work to get us out of it. The criticism is maybe we need to think outside the box. Maybe we need to step back and not think like Wall Street people. And you have to wonder if these people have what social scientists call a contaminated viewpoint, which is that they think like Wall Street. So how will they question Wall Street? And that's the tension.
And I can't imagine that this is something that the Obama administration really wants to broadcast, is that he has these, you know, Goldman Sachs is not real popular on
right.
the streets these days.
They haven't been secretive about it. That said, a lot of these people did not go through Senate confirmation. Geithner appointed them as counselors, which did keep them off of the Hill and off from the public glare that they would have gone through if they had been confirmed. So it's a little bit of a backdoor way in for Wall Street to help advise the government and the administration on where we're going to go now.
And has Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, has he responded to the reports about his counselors, I guess he's calling, not advisors, right? Counselors?
Counselors, right. A spokesman for the Treasury Department did respond and said, you know, we need people who know the markets to help advise us. So there is certainly some truth to that. The question is, how many do you need and do they have enough out-of-the-box viewpoints in their to argue with these Wall Street veterans.
Okay, Louise Story is the finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. And to sports again with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway's sports contributor. Okay, game one is tonight. We're going to see the National League Championship Series starting Los Angeles. It starts in Los Angeles.
Correct.
The Dodgers are playing the Philadelphia Phillies. So what should we be watching for in this game?
Well, we have two lefties going up against each other tonight. Cole Hamels of the defending champion Phillies is going up against Clayton Kershaw. He's had a little bit of a disappointing season, but Clayton Kershaw has the best ERA out of any of the pitchers on these two teams. In the season series that these two teams played, the Dodgers had the edge. They won 4-3. Most of those games were decided by three runs or fewer. And Clayton Kershaw played in two of those games, and he lost both of those games. So that's an interesting thing for tonight.
Yeah.
There's a couple other things I'm looking at. Jonathan Broxton, who's the closer for the Dodgers, he's opposing batters have a 1.65 batting average against him. So he's become an elite closer, and I think he's the difference maker. Another thing I'm looking at is the bench. The Dodgers also have a really deep bench.
Hitters.
They have three or four guys that could start for other teams, guys like Juan Pierre, Jim Thome, and people have heard of those names because they both have won World Series before. Another interesting thing is a game changer in Ryan Howard. He's hit 45 home runs since 2006 every year. Ryan Howard for the Phillies is swinging the bat amazingly. So look for at a critical moment in the sixth or seventh inning when Kershaw is still in the game, his curveball is not working so great anymore, his fastball might be a little bit slow, going against Ryan Howard at a critical moment in the game. That's when the Phillies will have to decide, are they going to go to their bullpen, which is not as strong as, I mean, that's when the Dodgers have to decide, are they going to go to their bullpen, which is stronger. And someone like Ryan Howard for the Phillies will be up at bat. If you have him against a weak starter, then he's going to take advantage of them. So it's going to be a tough game and a tough series. I think the Dodgers are going to win in seven.
Okay, so that's a very specific prediction. We're going to have to be watching that, Ibrahim. Now, we also have tomorrow coming up with the Yankees and the Angels.
Certainly. The Angels are going to put on John Lackey in New York here to start against CC Sabathia. The Yankees are going to use a three-man rotation, which means they're going to go with three starters instead of a four-starter rotation. Now, there's going to be some nuance in this because the weather's supposed to be bad coming in. So there's a storm coming in. So that's going to affect the game. It's probably going to be like 40 degrees, 30, 40 degrees around game time. So October baseball is really October baseball.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor, thanks so much.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
coming up in just a few moments. Smile and the world smiles with you, right? Wrongo, says Barbara Ehrenreich. We're going to talk with her about her new book, Bright-Sided, in just a few minutes. But first, a check-in on all the news headlines at 32 minutes past the hour with Mark Garrison.
Thank you. Wall Street just opened up 2 minutes ago. Right now, the Dow is down at 99.84. Yesterday, of course, it closed above 10,000 for the first time in a year. We'll watch that today, see if they get back above 10K. President Obama is about to leave for New Orleans. Revere McFadden is president of the Lower Ninth Ward Neighborhood Council. She says there's a lot she wants him to see.
We have children, and they deserve a state-of-the-art school. The community people are meeting, trying to raise funds to put a school up. We're just forgotten about down here.
It's the president's first visit to New Orleans since taking office in the White House. Social Security payments won't go up next year. There have been annual cost of living increases since 1975. President Obama wants to give out $250 payments to make up for the lack of an increase. The Boston Globe newspaper is no longer on the market. The New York Times Company, which owns the Globe, says the paper's financial situation is improved. As we say often, the New York Times is one of our partners here at The Takeaway. And J.C. Dugard is speaking publicly for the first time since she was released after 18 years in captivity with People magazine. And that's some of the stories we're watching this morning.
People who believe that human life is absolutely too important, too valuable, and too precious to be controlled by fear.
I believe that the invisible force of internal drive activated is the most important thing in the world. I'm here because I believe emotion is the force of life.
I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
So today we are talking about mind over matter, right? You think happy and so you are happy. We just heard a clip there from, among other people, Tony Robbins, who's a real motivational speaker. And we've also heard from Stuart Smalley, Jim Cunningham. They've all told us that if you think positively, that's going to have a major effect on your life. But we hear from Barbara Ehrenreich, that is not the case. She is, of course, famous for her 2001 bestseller, Nickel and Dimed. Her new book is called Bright-Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. Barbara, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, glad to be here.
I got to tell you, when I first started reading the book, I was like, where is she going with this? Because you were talking about the fact that Americans are addicted to always being positive about things. And when bad things happen in your life, you turn your lemons into lemonade, right? Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, how is this going to connect to how it's actually undermined the country? But amazingly enough, you built this incredibly research case for these motivational speakers like Tony Robbins and this attitudes toward always being positive about everything and not letting negativity creep into our lives. And you connect that to the economic downturn and the crisis in our economy. So let's start with this idea of positivity. And you trace it all the way back to Norman Vincent Peale and even before that to Calvinism. Why are Americans feel the need to always put things in a positive light?
Well, whether we feel it or not, it's become more or less mandatory in a lot of situations. I encountered it first when I was a breast cancer patient. And, you know, it was in the books and on the websites available where I reached out for support. And what I found was all these instructions that I had to be positive or I would not recover.
Positive attitude was going to help cure your cancer.
Oh, absolutely. And that doesn't just apply to breast cancer. I mean, that's sort of part of the popular culture now, you know, and even a lot of doctors will endorse it, although there's nothing to it, sadly.
Right, there's no research.
Well, I don't know if I should say sadly, because the effort to think positively when you're having a terrible crisis in your life is an additional burden. It's, more work. But the major way people encounter this is at the workplace. Where, you know, the boss will bring in motivational speakers. He may distribute motivational books and
DVDs,
inspirational posters. And this is where the danger comes in. There has been a tendency to fire people who are negative. Now, by negative, I mean that can just mean raising questions, expressing doubts, so that in the buildup to the financial meltdown, you had people who were trying to say, there's something wrong here. We're worried. Like the head of the division of real estate at Lehman Brothers. Yeah. And he went to the CEO and said, I think this is a housing bubble and we're going to be in big trouble soon. So he gets fired for that. because that was negative.
Now, you point out that the CEO of Lehman Brothers was well known for going by his instinct, and you didn't have to look at indicators. You knew in your heart that things were going well, right?
Yeah, now this sort of shocked me about what positive thinking did to the corporate culture. You know, I used to think it must be that the business world is rational, right? Bottom line, et
right.
cetera. But by the late 90s and into this decade, the idea was, no, you don't need all that analysis. You don't need all those decision trees and, you know, that kind of analysis going on. All you need is a guy at the top who's like a cult leader who sort of emanates positivity and optimism and who has wonderful sudden intuitions about
right.
what to do.
So you track this going through a religion and all these mega churches in which they don't talk about sin or even have images of Jesus Christ on the cross anymore, but they talk about going to God and visualizing yourself in the big house and visualizing yourself because God wants us all to be happy and have the things that we want. But you also say that you kind of track the fact that maybe originally corporations were using these positive motivational speakers to get more work out of their employees after layoffs, but they kind of bought it. They bought the farm, right?
Yeah. No, it grows within the corporate world with the era of downsizing that really began in the 80s. And it became a way to kind of quell dissent among the people who were being laid off, not that there was much that they could do, but also to squeeze more work out of the survivors. You brought in the motivational speaker and you slapped the posters up on the wall just as the layoffs were starting. And you know, so that it's the same. You know, you take a person who has cancer or you take a person who's just lost their job and is in danger of spiraling into poverty and you say, hey, put a smiley face on. It's everything depends on your attitude.
Which was stunning to me when you were talking about your experience in breast cancer. You quoted some women who said, I'm so glad I had breast cancer because it's really improved my life.
Yeah, that's where I really gagged. You know, there's this idea that you should not only embrace it positively, but you should consider your cancer as a gift because it's going to make you more spiritual, more evolved, more sensitive. It did not do that to me, I will have to admit.
But
it's the same with unemployment, layoffs. They'll say, this is a wonderful opportunity. This is the best thing that ever happened to you.
So now, very quickly, what you're not saying is that people need to go around complaining all the time.
No, the alternative is not negative thinking and sullenness. The alternative, if I may dare propose anything so radical as this, is realism. Trying to understand what's actually happening, what's behind it, and what we do about it.
That's Barbara Ehrenreich. Her new book is called Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. Stay with us. We'll take an intimate look at the top commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry will return tomorrow. So this week, 8 injured Iraqi war veterans returned to the former battlegrounds. They're not there reporting for duty. They're doing it to help heal the emotional wounds after their injuries. It's part of a program called Operation Proper Exit. We're joined now by Rod Norland. He's a foreign correspondent in Baghdad for our partner, The New York Times, and he profiles this program in the morning's paper. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning.
So this program, what does it actually do? It takes injured veterans back to the place where they were injured, correct?
That's right. A lot of them, most of them, in fact, left unconscious. And they come, once they get to their injuries taken care of, they have a kind of overwhelming sense that they want to go back and be with the guys that they left and see what's happened since. And particularly now that things have gotten better, a lot of them see it as therapeutic to actually go back and see that maybe the amputated limb that they lost, it was actually in a good cause.
This is expected to give them some kind of closure so that they can move on, right?
Yes, and only a few people have done it so far, 5 in June with very little fanfare, and then these 8 now. And they all have reported, so far at least, they've reported that it's helped them quite a lot to cope. On the other hand, these guys are selected because they're already coping pretty well, and they probably aren't very typical of most badly wounded veterans, you know, who have a very difficult time.
So who is paying for this program? This is not part of the U.S. government, right?
No, but the military was supporting it. And, of course, they gave them facilities and flew them around and everything. But a group called Troops First, which is a private foundation with some private money and also support from USO, financed it. And they did it rather generously. They flew the guys out in business class so they'd be comfortable on the 13-hour flight out and really made sure they all felt like VIPs.
So the first time they did this particular thing was back in June. And what did the soldiers who participated in then say? Did they consider it a success? Did they feel like it helped them?
They did. A lot of them reported that they had had, which is quite common, I think, they'd had night terrors previously, and that after making this trip, that had gone away. Now, how long that's lasted, if it's still the case, or if it's a permanent or just a temporary fix, we couldn't really say, I don't think. And I don't think any serious scientific study of just the kind of effect of bringing guys back to an active war zone, just what kind of effect that will have long term.
And is this going to continue after this group comes back? Are there more groups planning to go?
This group plans to keep coming, yes. They have no shortage of guys who want to come. And they're hoping to actually turn it into something they do monthly, although it's hard to see how they'll get the same sort of VIP treatment if they're coming monthly. I mean, on this trip, they saw all the top generals and political leaders and so forth, and it might be a bit burdensome to do that on such a regular basis. But apparently Odierno, the commanding general, Ray Odierno, is a big supporter of the program, and so is the Surgeon General's Office of the Army.
Okay, Rod Nordland, thanks so much. He's the Baghdad foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's 47 minutes past the hour. Time to check in on news headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Celeste. Wall Street just opened a few minutes ago. Right now, so far, the Dow's kind of been bouncing around that 10,000 mark all morning. Yesterday, it closed above 10,000 for the first time in a year. And traders will have lots of fresh numbers to crunch this morning. New jobless claims are at the lowest level since January. Inflation is up slightly, and key financial firms have earnings reports just out today. Goldman Sachs is posting big profits, and Citigroup reporting major losses. In Pakistan, dozens are dead after a series of militant attacks on new government buildings today. And looking ahead to later this afternoon, the president is headed to New Orleans. That is his first visit there as president. He will survey the rebuilding there and tour the only school to reopen in the lower Ninth Ward. Also tonight, the Battle for Baseball's World Series starts. The Philadelphia Phillies take on the Los Angeles Dodgers for the National League title, and the American League Championship Series begins tomorrow. That's the Angels versus the LA Angels of Anaheim versus the New York Yankees. And those are some of the stories we're following. Celeste.
We're expecting in its decision from President Obama sometime this month about whether or not to increase the number of troops that we send to Afghanistan. But a question posed by Dexter Filkins in this weekend's New York Times magazine is it already too late to win in Afghanistan? Dexter Filkins is correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and author of The Forever War. He joins us now from Istanbul. Good morning, Dexter.
Hi.
You spent a lot of time profiling the top commander in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, and he's certainly a very interesting character. I've read he comes from a military family, but there's all kinds of stories about him, about how he only eats one meal a day and gets up at the crack of dawn to go running. Tell me a little bit about Stanley McChrystal.
Well, he's all those things. He's pretty extraordinary. I mean, on one hand, you have a guy who's kind of a perfect physical specimen. He does. He sleeps 4 or 5 hours a night. Just seems to exist on black coffee, one meal a day. He pushes himself very, very hard. His cheeks are gaunt and sunken, and he's coiled and alert all the time. And yet, on the other hand, he's a very thoughtful guy, and you can tell by talking to him and watching him work. He's well read. He's relentlessly curious just by the questions that he asks people when you see him work. So on one hand, he's very much a warrior in the old school, but at the same time, clearly he's a very sharp guy.
Well, this doesn't sound very old school. This is General Stanley McChrystal.
I found in my experience that the best answers and approaches may be counterintuitive, i.e. the opposite of what it seems like you ought to do is what ought to be done.
So when I'm asked the question of what approach should we take in Afghanistan, I say humility.
So Dexter Filkins, foreign correspondent for the New York Times, humility, that's not what we're used to hearing out of our generals?
No, but I think that's it in a nutshell. And I think what the United States learned, certainly in Iraq, and McChrystal spent 5 years in Iraq, basically in charge of commandos who went after terrorists and insurgents. But the lesson that they took away from Iraq was that you can't kill and capture your way out of something like this. That the supply of insurgents and people who hate you is essentially limitless. So if you just try to shoot them all, you'll be there forever. But instead, the approach now, and I think what they take away from Iraq, was that what worked is to make friends with the overwhelming majority of the people. And if you do that, and you do that by being humble and not telling people, imposing your views or your philosophies on people. But if you make friends with ordinary people and the vast majority of people, the insurgents will become marginalized. They'll wither away. And so that's a very different approach. So in a nutshell, killing Taliban is probably about the least important thing that's expected of American soldiers these days in Afghanistan.
That's one of the things that you write about in your article. And yet British Prime Minister Gordon Brown said he would send more troops to Afghanistan only if NATO and the Afghan government start to fight the Taliban more. So how do we reconcile what General McChrystal said about the Taliban not being the focus and what Prime Minister Gordon Brown wants?
Well, I think you can. I mean, and the reason is this. If you take where the British are and that's Helmand Province in the south, it's the most violent place. It's where all the opium comes from. The Taliban are very, very strong there. You've had the British have been there for years, only about 8,000 troops, nowhere near enough. This is the place where 10,000 American Marines just landed over the summer. They were sent there by President Obama. They are having to fight their way into places where no American or British soldiers have been. I mean, I was in a small place called Mian Poshte. It's in the south of the province along the Helmand River, and it's the first time that. That American soldiers have ever been down there, and there have been no British before them. And so the Taliban own the place. And so you can do all these things, but you first have to, of course, establish your presence, and that's what they're doing, and that requires fighting. And so the unit that I was with, the 2nd Battalion, 8th Regiment of the Marines, they fight every day. And if they don't go after the Taliban come after them. And so the fighting is very intense right now. And I think in a way that's what you saw in Iraq. I don't like to compare the two countries, and this certainly is not a surge that they're doing in Afghanistan. But if you remember, before the violence dropped dramatically in Iraq, it went up and it spiked. And that's for basically the same reason. The Americans had to fight their way into places where they had not been before. And so I think that to answer your question, that's what Prime Minister Brown is thinking about when he says that.
Well, give us a sense for what things are like for the Afghani people. I mean, you went on foot patrols. You guys were walking through cornfields trying to avoid IEDs on the roads. It's 130 degrees there. You spoke with the villagers who are dealing with this fighting on a daily basis, and many of them didn't vote in the elections because the polling places were 6 hours away. They said they're not seeing signs of stable government. What are things like for the Afghani people?
Well, Afghanistan is like, it's like you're in the Old Testament. I mean, it's like the 4th century there. There's no electricity. There's no telephones. There's no running water. There are no paved roads. There are no schools. There's no hospitals. There's nothing. And so I think when we were down there in these very, very primitive conditions, going into places where the Taliban have basically controlled for years, the people are basically caught in the middle of this. And so they've got the Taliban on one side saying, if you cooperate with the Americans, we'll cut your throat. And then you've got the Americans showing up and saying, hey, we want to be your friend. And, you know, we want to do projects and we want to have elections and all these other things. And at the same time, the Americans are trying to bring in the Afghan government, which, you know, doesn't exist in any way down there. And so the vast majority of the people, as far as I could see, are just stuck in the middle. They want peace. They want what everybody else wants in this world, which is just to be left alone. And And yet they find that very, very hard to get to. And so when you come to them and you start to ask them questions, this is what they say. They say, if I cooperate with you, the Taliban will be here tonight and they'll kill my whole family. And so that's what it's like to be an Afghan these days, particularly in a place like Helmand Province.
Well, you in the magazine, you write that the lack of accomplishment is manifest wherever you go. So do you think that if President Obama honors Stanley McChrystal's request, if he brings more 40,000 more troops to Afghanistan, is there a chance of winning this war?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, and I don't. I'm just
64,000.
I'm a reporter, and I'm only a reporter, and it's hard enough to figure out
right,
what happened yesterday.
Right, but I mean, in some of these things, would extra troops have helped the Echo Company accomplish their goals?
Of course they would. I think the question, the real question that I think people should try to think about, I mean, as voters, and which President Obama is undoubtedly thinking about is, okay, I give you the 60,000 or the 40,000 or 20,000. How long is it going to take, and what's the price? And I think that's what troubled me when I was there. That's the thing that I kept trying to think about, which is, let's say they get everything they need to do this and to build a government. How long is it going to take, and what's the cost? And I think all those things are very high. I mean, I think if the Americans prevail in Afghanistan, if General McChrystal gets the troops he wants, you're still talking about many years. More dead and a lot more money. And there may be no alternative to that. Remember, this is the place where Al-Qaeda came from and brought September and brought the 9/11 attacks. Yeah. And so that's the dilemma. There are no easy choices here. I remember General Casey said, George Casey in Iraq said to me once, if it was easy, we would have done it by now.
Dexter Filkins, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. That's a takeaway if I ever heard one. If it was easy, we would have done it by now. By the way, keep the calls coming. The president's in New Orleans today, and if he was coming to your hometown, what would he need to fix there?
My name is Rich from Detroit, and I want him to fix something first before I could know he could fix anything.
Tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm David Remnick, host of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.